Coming up on Golf Today, Chris Kirk has joy in his life and a new trophy on the shelf. We catch up with the Georgia Bulldog and winner of the Century at Kapalua in moments. And Rory McIlroy made some news in Dubai, and Golf Digest's John Huggin was there to hear it. A chat with Huggin coming up next. Plus, Gary Woodland about to make his first start since brain surgery in September. Todd Lewis spent some time with the U.S. Open champion, a conversation not to be missed on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Wednesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. We come into work on the eve of some tournaments. Things start looking at tee times and start thinking about things inside the ropes. It's going to be another busy day outside the ropes.
It really is. Change is the new normal in this game now, and it seems as though every bit of news revolves a revolving door. Mm. Somebody's coming, somebody's going.
We do begin with some news on this Wednesday. One of the longtime fixtures in the game of golf set to say goodbye 9 years after taking on the job. The CEO of the RNA, Martin Slumbers, has announced he will step down from his role at the end of 2024. Slumbers will oversee the running of this year's Open Championship at Royal Troon, the AIG Women's Open at the Old Course at St. Andrews, and the Curtis Cup matches at Sunningdale before he steps down. Now, we do have this statement from Martin Slumbers. It has been a privilege to serve golf at the highest level. It is a role that I have been proud to carry out on behalf of the RNA's employees, the members of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, and all our global partners. In any career, there is a time to allow the next generation to have its turn. I am grateful to have had the honor for nearly a decade to have been the custodian of all that the RNA and the game of golf more broadly represents. And taking a look at the bio, you've held the job since 2015, previously worked in investment banking, spending 12 years at Salomon Brothers International, and earned a Bachelor of Sciences in Production Engineering and Economics from the University of Birmingham. Eamon, how about this news? A bit of a surprise, I would say, on this Wednesday.
To an extent, though, 9 years in that job is a pretty stout tenure. And he's probably going to be acknowledged, or the legacy will be remembered, on the big issues, you know, being the ally of Mike Wan on this distance insights and trying to rein in the golf ball a little bit. Considerably advancing the purse in the Women's British Open as another example of that, and various sort of rules and handicap change. It will focus on the big issues. He probably deserves more credit for the stuff that kind of happens in the wings around the accessibility in this game, that introducing essentially a disabilities open. There was a women's amateurs that he created in Africa and in Latin America under the auspices of the RNA. So he's done more to grow the game in real sense than a lot of the people who talk about growing the game. Slumbers at least has a record that he can point to.
There may be no greater legacy than the merger between the RNA and the Ladies Golf Union in 2017. And you think about what happened in the years that followed. Justin Rose, for example, in 2020, launching the Rose Ladies Golf Series. And Justin Rose saying, you know what, little girls and boys dream about the same thing, but it's the platform and opportunity that are skewed. So I think by following the lead of a Martin Slumbers and having those purses elevated and more opportunities for the women around the world to play the best venues in the world and have those purses that are more comparable, a little closer to what the men make, that's a part of his legacy, I believe, as well.
Yeah, there's a definite equity that he can point to that he's created. He's very much he's a traditionalist in the Tweedy sense that we associate with Scottish golf. He's an institutionalist, let's put it like that. And that's been evidenced in a lot of different ways. And he's gotten a lot of criticism for that along the way, particularly in his analysis every year at the Open about the competitive integrity of the LIV Golf Tour and whether or not that represented a good movement within the golf ecosystem, but whether or not the competition itself was worthy. The fact that he insisted that the Open would not go back to Turnberry as long as Donald Trump owned the golf course, because he could not be assured that the Open itself would be the focus rather than any kind of theatrics or politics that would go on around that. These are all things that Slumbers took a very firm line in the sand on. And obviously the lasting legacy, I think, is probably going to be the distance argument because he and Mike Wan eventually were the two guys who advanced that argument down the field somewhere. There's a long way to go on that, but it's at such a stage now that his successor, whoever that will be, is not going to be backtracking on that issue.
Steps down during a very fraught, interesting time, compelling time in our game. I do think for him personally to be able to walk away at Royal Troon, at the Old Course, at Sunningdale. You know, in sports, sometimes when the longtime fixtures of a sport say goodbye, you get the rocking chair or the surfboard or the motorcycle. Hope he's able to kind of smell the flowers a little bit as he does exit stage left.
No chance. There's a lot of headaches Martin's going to have to deal with between now and then. Mm. Let's get back inside the ropes. On Sunday out in Maui, it's Chris Kirk who added a signature win to his career resume, shot a final round 65 to secure his sixth PGA Tour victory by a single shot over Sahith Theegala. And with that win, Kirk jumped to 25th in the official World Golf ranking. It's a pretty impressive resume, Chris Kirk. He's built up with 6 PGA Tour wins, a 3 Korn Ferry Tour wins. He's been on the President's Cup team and, of course, that Walker Cup team, the standout team back in 2007. And Chris Kirk joins us now from the Sony Open. Chris, congratulations on the latest victory. I was struck by the comment you made on Sunday after the win that it didn't bother you that the successes are put in the context of past struggles. Do you feel as though that is a message you're sending to other people who might be struggling out there, that turnarounds and getting your life in order is eminently possible?
Yeah, absolutely. Hope you can hear me now. Yep. You know, it's definitely a big part of my story. I was asked the question, you know, are we ever going to, you know, stop talking about this and move on to just the golf? And I said, I hope not. You know, it's a huge part of my life. It's still, I would say, the biggest accomplishment in my life and has allowed me to do the things that I've been doing lately.
Chris, one thing you said on Sunday was that you want to be proud of the man you see in the mirror. Who do you see now?
I just see somebody who's doing his best, you know. I love the old quote, all you can do is all you can do, but all you can do is enough. You know, that's comes from Mr. Art Williams, who's a friend of mine, and it's a great quote, and I'm trying to live by it.
All you can do is your best, a great motto for life right there. Whenever you've had success in the last few years, Chris, have you heard from other people who've reached out to you who do have addiction issues of their own and who draw something from your example?
Yeah, absolutely. I get a lot of people will come and speak to me at tournaments, and then I've made a lot of connections on social media, which has been great, and been able to try to, you know, share a few words of encouragement, a little bit of advice here and there, and get some back from them as well. So that's the connection of people that are kind of sharing a similar struggle is one of the biggest parts of the recovery process for sure.
Chris, what about support from your PGA Tour peers and from the PGA Tour itself as you've made your way back to sobriety and also doing what you say brings you so much joy?
Yeah, I've got a great group of peers, a great sort of friend group out here that we, you know, rent houses on the road and all stay together and, you know, playing practice rounds together, going out to dinner. So it's been, you know, I probably stay in 2 hotels a year or something like that. So that has really improved my quality of life on the road, I would say, to have that group of really close friends. We're all, you know, very competitive with each other, obviously, but pulling for each other. And it's just made it, you know, just a joy to be out here rather than, you know, sitting in a hotel room by yourself.
Chris, I was struck watching you during the final round at Maui. You were walking down a fairway and you looked as though you could have had flip-flops on and a towel over your shoulder heading for the beach. And I'm thinking, this guy can't possibly be as unruffled as he appears right now. What were the insides like? Because it had to rank as the biggest victory of your career, perhaps right behind the Deutsche Bank, or at least on a par with it. But there had to be nerves there, were there?
Yeah, I was very nervous. And, you know, that's something that last year, you know, I was able to get the win at the Honda. Was fantastic. But I had, as the year went on, some weeks where I didn't play as well as I would have liked on Sunday and didn't respond to nerves as well as I would have liked. So that's something that I dug into and worked on a lot this offseason. Zach Sorensen, who's the mental coach for the Atlanta Braves, is somebody I've worked with for about a year now. And we've just really kind of gotten into it and worked on a lot of different things. And my sort of mantra, I guess, on Saturday, but especially on Sunday, was just sort of walking into every shot was just kind of saying, okay, it doesn't matter if you're uncomfortable, it doesn't matter if you're nervous, there's still no reason why you can't hit a great shot right now. And that kind of gave me just enough sort of calm and peace of mind to really be able to execute well.
And then you get to 17, though, on Sunday, Chris, and you go from 7-iron to 5-iron. I want to nerd out a little bit. You know, you hear guys going from gap wedge to pitching wedge or maybe a one-club difference, but to have the trust to go from 7 to 5-iron, three-finger that beauty to 2.5 feet, just describe that whole process and pulling off that quality shot.
Yeah, that was wild for sure. I can't really recall another time in my career where that's happened, and especially at such a pivotal moment. But, you know, the wind had been relatively light kind of out of the north most of the day, and we got up on 17T. It started blowing a little bit harder. It was pretty much straight in, and I hit a great drive, but with it playing into the wind, it was a good bit further back than I had been previously in the week. And we get down to the ball, and it's blowing straight down. You know, 180-degree switch from what we had on the tee shot. And if I had been first to hit, yeah, I would have pulled out 7-iron and hit it. You know, I had 192 adjusted. You know, the wind was just sort of all over the place for a minute. Akshay took a minute, understandably so, with the wind was all over the place. And by the time it was my turn to hit, it kind of settled back to into. And we had seen Michael, my caddy, and I on 17 and 18, some of those shots, they play 15 yards downhill or whatever it may be, but hitting off of the downslope like that, you don't really get the full downhill effect. So with that wind being back in, you know, a stock 5-iron for me is about 210. I tried to hit that one about 205, and thankfully I was able to get into it and really trust what I was doing and make a great swing.
Yeah, Damon's stock 5-iron goes 210 as well, Chris. I'm curious, are you a goal setter? I mean, you win the first tournament of the year, so I'm curious what your goals were before you even got to Kapalua, and what are your goals? Have they been reset in any manner as you move towards the rest of the year?
Yeah, that's something that I'm going to have to look at. I've never really been much of a goal setter. I've been, you know, completely just dig into the process type of person and, you know, not worry about the results. But I have talked a little bit more with my team of people, like, you know, about let's go win tournaments. And to get it done the first week, obviously, is a little bit of, you know, where you're kind of like, what now? And I think a little bit of that happened to me last year as well. You know, I hadn't won so long. That was a big goal for me last year, won earlier in the year. And then I didn't do a great job of reassessing and resetting goals. And so that's something that I actually will plan on spending some time on the phone this afternoon with Zach and with Michael, my caddy, and just sort of go through it like, okay, what, you know, instead of just sitting around wondering what now, let's decide what now.
Chris, before we let you go, listen, it looks like a spectacular morning. I want to dive into the television set and just hang out with you right now. How beautiful is it this morning on this Pro-Am day? Not always fun to wake up early for a Pro-Am, but my goodness, if there's a day to wake up early for a Pro-Am, today is the day.
Couldn't be more perfect out here. You know, not really any wind yet. Just a perfect temperature out here this morning. It's just unbelievable. But before I go, I want to give a big shout-out to my guys at Callaway Golf. Obviously, I think they're the best equipment in the game, but mostly the people. The guys in the truck, Jacob, Joe, Kellen, Johnny, Greg, everybody in the truck, they do such a great job taking care of me and the other players out here. Just want to give them a big thank you.
Chris, they got a lot of people supporting you and pulling for you. Congratulations on win number 6, and thank you for sharing your story, and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. 6 wins. That sounds good. Let's keep it going.
There he is, the Georgia Bulldog, Chris Kirk, on a Wednesday. Still ahead on golf today. The Latin America Amateur Championship is around the corner with a Masters invitation as well as exemptions in the U.S. Open and Open on the line. Coming up next will be the member of my UCLA Bruins men's golf team who will be teeing it up in Panama.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
We're back on Golf Today. The ninth edition of the Latin America Amateur Championship will be contested at Santa Maria Golf Club, Panama City, Panama. That begins January 18th through the 21st. The LAAC is returning to Panama for the second time in the event's history, but it's the first time they've played at Santa Maria. And a lot goes along with a victory at the Latin America Amateur Championship. The winner receives exemptions into this year's Masters, the US Open at Pinehurst, and the Open Championship at Royal Troon. A lot of notable past participants, including the 2018 winner, Joaquin Niemann.
One of the players competing this year, Omar Morales. Currently a junior on the UCLA men's golf team, two-time Pac-12 Golfer of the Week. In the fall of last year, earned three top five finishes in a row, including a victory, and of course had the opening tee shot, you may recall, at the Los Angeles Country Club during the U.S. Open. Shot, what, 32, I want to say, in its opening nine. And so he led after that opening nine. Had played a couple PGA Tour events besides U.S. Open and the Open at Vedanta in Mexico, and a couple of college wins at UCLA. And Omar joins us now. It's great to see you again. It was great meeting you in Los Angeles. How about those three straight top five finishes to conclude the fall, including a win? How much momentum are you carrying into the Latin America Amateur Championship?
Yeah, great meeting you too. Thanks for having me. Yeah, a lot of momentum. I think I had a great fall. A win at the Golf Club of Georgia was nice, and yeah, couldn't be more excited for next week.
Omar, what is the value of the Latin America Amateur Championship? Because it's probably not as well understood as it ought to be. But when you come from countries in the Caribbean and Latin America, where there perhaps isn't as deep and as rich a golf history as in other corners of the world, what is the opportunity that this tournament represents?
I think it provides a lot of value, and I think it's a great opportunity for every player, playing in the event. You know, I think every golfer dreams of playing in the Masters and the U.S. Open and the Open. So to have a tournament for Latin American amateurs to qualify for those three events is, you know, something that everybody and anybody dreams of. So, yeah, I think everybody's excited for next week. And, you know, you just got to play great golf to get your hands on the trophy.
Well, not everyone in the field next week can say that they played in a U.S. Open. You know, shot three under on his opening nine, has played in a PGA Tour event like you have in Mexico. How much do you feel like those experiences against the professionals will help you next week against the amateurs?
I mean, yeah, I those were great learning experiences, especially the U.S. Open and, you know, having a taste of the lead after nine holes. So, yeah, I think I, you know, that has changed me a little bit to the player I am right now. And I learned a lot from those couple weeks. So I don't know if it gives me an advantage or not, but yeah, it certainly changed me as a player. And it gave me a lot of learning that I needed at some point.
I'm curious what that learning is, Omar, because I know the US Open had to be a big week for you, but playing the Mexico Open at Vedanta on the PGA Tour had to be enormous view as well, because suddenly you're out there measuring yourself on the range and on the golf course next to the best players in the world. When you finished that week, what did you come away with? Because when you did that the next time in the US Open qualifier at Hillcrest, you put in a couple of 65s and easily made your way in to that US Open. So there had to be some real positive takeaways from Mexico.
I completely agree with you. I think I learned a lot of things, but I think the major learning experience that I had at the Mexico Open was not trying to be perfect, not forcing any shots, just letting things happen. And I don't need to birdie every single hole. Yeah, I think that was a big stepping stone for me. And I think that's one of the reasons that I qualified for the US Open. And I played so well in the qualifying because I just, played my game and didn't really try to force to hit shots perfect and, you know, didn't get ahead of myself.
Omar, how deep is the college game these days in terms of the talent that you see week to week when you're competing against peers from other schools? Because it looks like it's as good as you'll ever find it in terms of this current crop of collegians.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think it's really deep right now, and I think, that's one of the reasons you see, amateurs playing in tour events and making the cut, and that's what you're seeing with Ludwig right now, and Gordon Sargeant making the cut at the Open and finishing pretty well, and Christo leading after one round at the British Open. So yeah, I think it's incredible right now, and it has gotten to a great level, and I think it's really hard to win in college. So yeah, I think it's really unbelievable.
Omar, you're accomplishing a lot already in your young career as well. Best of luck next week in Panama. When you're back on campus, give it a hug for me if you don't mind, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. I will. Thanks for having me.
Well, most of the news in golf this week has come from the old world. Rory McIlroy talking about the future of golf in Dubai. Martin Slumbers announcing his departure from the RNA. So after the break, John Huggan is going to join us from Dubai to talk about those topics. Stay with us.
Turning our attention now to the big news from today. 9 years after taking on the job as CEO of the RNA, Martin Slumbers has announced that he will step down from his role at the end of 2024. Slumbers will oversee the running of this year's Open Championship at Royal Troon, the AIG Women's Open at St. Andrews, and the Curtis Cup matches at Sunningdale before he steps down. And Golf Digest John Huggan joins us now from Dubai. John, I want to start with the news of the day. Martin Slumbers saying he will step down as CEO of the RNA at the end of the year. What was the reaction on the ground in Dubai?
Well, I think mild surprise. I mean, or maybe not too much. I think when Martin arrived, I think I remember him saying to the world that he was going to stay between 5 and 10 years, and this would be his 9th year this year. So he's been true to his word in that respect. But yes, I spoke to Rory and Luke Donald and Tommy Fleetwood today, and they were all very complimentary. I mean, they weren't, lavish in their praise, but I think there's always a kind of arm's length distance between the amateur body and the professionals. But they were all very nice and then said some nice things about him on his way out the door.
What is the Slumbers legacy, John, from where you stand? You've covered him for the entire tenure and a lot of his predecessors as well. What will the legacy of Martin Slumbers be in this role?
Well, he's moved things on very much in a business sense. The RNA, they've come a long way from the first time I came across the RNA, there was very much just the golf club that kind of ran a few tournaments, the Open included. Now they're very much a business. Some might argue too much. They've gone in that direction. It's very much a money-making machine these days. They've kind of lost the golf club aspect of it, to some might say too much of an extent. But yeah, I mean, he's moved things on with the Open. The Open's the only source of income the RNA has, and they make an awful lot of money now, even if, I might argue that the event has lost a little bit of its charm with the qualifying systems that they have now. They've lost the final qualifying, and it's gone all ticket, which it probably had to do in Portrush 3 or 4 years ago. But it's maybe just a reflection of the modern world. And Martin came to the job as a very successful businessman, and that was the talents that he brought to it, and he's certainly come through.
John, have you seen an elevation of the women's game in the UK and beyond, considering the merger between the RNA and the Ladies Golf Union under Martin's watch, for example?
Yeah, that's been a big thing for him. I mean, he's trumpeted the cause of women in golf almost from day one. And you're right, the Women's Open has gone on. I mean, it's leaps and bounds better than it used to be. I mean, and this year it's going to be back at the old course at St. Andrews, which doesn't really come any better than that. So if he's going to be, if you're going to say the Slumbers legacy, if you like, that would be high on the list.
Slumbers was also quite explicit in the last few years, John, in saying that the Open would not return to Turnberry, effectively as long as Donald Trump's name was above the door, for fear that the Open itself might not be the focus of that week. Is that something you think is likely to change with a successor in the role, or is that just ingrained within the RNA that they're not willing to risk the Open being upstud?
I think you can take it that as long as Mr. Trump, or President Trump, his name is attached to Turnberry, sadly, the Open will not be going back there. I mean, I was there few years ago now when the Women's Open was played at Turnberry, and Trump showed up. This is before he was president, and man, he just disrupted the whole thing. I mean, it was like everybody started watching him rather than the golf. And I think that kind of tipped the RNA off to the fact that that Trump in the Open certainly wouldn't be a good mix.
Well, speaking of the game around the world, John, I know you mentioned a conversation with Rory McIlroy, and he talked about the future of the game globally, potentially elevating some of these national opens. What did you take from that conversation? Because I thought that Rory was kind of stepping away from talking about global issues in the game, but he seems to be not nearly right back to where he was, but at least not shy from making his voice heard.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching a clip of you guys yesterday, and I think Eamon had it right that Rory's biggest problem, if you can call it that, is that when someone asks him a question, he tends to answer it, which is what he did yesterday with me. You can call him naive and everything, and he's maybe the shift in Rory is maybe away from idealism towards realism in on the subject of what's going to happen in the professional world of golf over the next few months. But yeah, I mean, I loved his idea. I'm not sure that it's entirely practical, given the number of national associations that would be involved if you were, you know, having the South African Open, Australian Open, Canadian Open. You're bringing in all kinds of alphabet soup of bodies involved in the decision-making process, and it might be just too much. But if you're talking about an ideal world, it's hard to argue with that scenario, really.
Yeah, it ticks all the boxes in terms of what you'd like to see in terms of taking the game at the elite level back to places with a rich history like Australia and South Africa, John. But the DP World Tour, one could argue, has had that global tour for quite a number of years. And you've talked to as many guys in that organisation as I have, and the corporate support on the ground is very seldom there, particularly at the level that these guys now think they ought to be paid for. So unless the Saudis are financing every pot and purse that they play for around the world, how realistic do you think it is in an economic sense to try to create that world tour?
Well, it's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. I mean, you're right when you say that the corporate sponsorship hasn't been there in places like Australia, but maybe that's only because the Australian Open hasn't been able to guarantee a field on the level that would attract the kind of corporate sponsorship we're talking about. If you're bringing along, you know, virtually every top player in the world, I have to think that that's a product that if you can't sell that to the corporate Australia, you're in real trouble. So, as I say, it's a chicken and egg thing. If you bring the players, I would imagine that the money would follow. I would hope that anyway.
Bringing the players is, of course, the key issue. And Rory mentioned this today, the idea of contracting the players, which one could argue is the only thing that LIV has actually gotten right to this point in being able to tell people who is actually going to show up. Golfers tend to hang on to this notion that they're independent contractors. How realistic or likely is it, do you think, that the top 15, 20 guys would agree to be contracted for that kind of circuit?
Well, it would depend on the contract, the terms of the contract, obviously. If we're talking about, a 20-tournament circuit plus the majors for the top players to play in, you'd have to think, if you said, right, OK, you can play in 16 of them. You have to play in 16. You can pick the 16. You get to skip four of them. I mean, that isn't too unattractive, especially when we're talking about the huge sums of money that would be involved. So, again, I think that everything's negotiable. And, you know, money talks in the end. And if you've got enough money, as you said, you've pointed out many times about the Saudis, you're right on that. The players will come. I think the players would do it just simply because of the money.
Everybody has a price, as Jason Day said in conversation reference about Jon Rahm. Much more with John Huggan after the break. We'll talk about Rory McIlroy chasing the career Grand Slam. Luke Donald, Jon Rahm coming up next on Golf Today. Back on Golf Today, the notables in the field of the Dubai Invitational, 60-man field at Dubai Creek, by most accounts, a gentle entry into the 2024 DP World Tour season for the likes of Rory McIlroy, Tommy Fleetwood, Luke Donald, and Ryan Fox. Back with John Huggan now in Dubai. I want to talk about Rory McIlroy, the player, of course, looking for a fifth major championship, looking for a green jacket to complete the career Grand Slam. How did you find his kind of sense of mind, his demeanor going into 2024?
Well, this is if you're going to have a relaxed week in professional golf, this is it. I think the number of players that have said to me already this week, this is a lovely warm up for next week. That gives you the kind of sense of the vibe of this tournament. I think it's a pro-am format. I think it's the first one of the year for many of the players. I think it's just a way of, you know, getting rid of the rust and the excesses of the holiday period and looking forward to what's to come after this. So in that sense, Rory was typical. I think he's here enjoying himself. He's here as a favour to a friend. And I think he'll get better and better as the week goes on. I walked 9 holes with him yesterday. Rory, he's often, I think he wonders why some people like me and Eamon, you know, walk holes with him sometimes, but I can speak for myself. I mean, I just like watching him play golf. Sometimes I'm out there with no agenda whatsoever. It's just fun to watch him.
In your conversation with him, John, you got into the idea of team golf and what it might look like, because it's clearly going to be a part of whatever this new dispensation is that we're moving towards. And he talked about the idea of team golf being based on the model of the Indian Premier League in cricket. Can you explain to the audience just the broad parameters of what that actually means with the IPL comparison?
Yeah, we have to remember I'm Scottish English, not English, Eamon, so I'll do my best. But it's not to go too deeply into it. It started off as a kind of rebel tour idea. It was pushed away by the establishment, but then they had enough money to promote some leverage, obviously, and the establishment have now accommodated the people who run the IPL, and they allocated maybe a couple of months of each year where the top players can go off, earn all kinds of money playing in the IPL, and then come back and be part of the establishment again. I think that's kind of how Rory would see it happening in golf. The players would be a couple of months, maybe a month at the start and a month at the end of the year, allocated to this new team format, and the players could go off and play and earn as much money and then come back and play in the established tours.
If that was to be the scenario, and then you set aside 2 months for team golf, that's 8 weeks out of the schedule. And we're going to start from the assumption that these guys will play a couple of dozen weeks a year. That's all they're willing to work. Yeah. And you take out the majors and the players and a handful of the elite PGA Tour signature events and Wentworth and Dubai and presumably a stop in Saudi Arabia, that leaves a lot of tournaments probably on the margins or potentially frozen out. Do you think there's going to be a concern among the rank and file on either tour, on either side of the Atlantic, that sponsors might not be as willing to support those events given the difficulty they're going to have in attracting an elite field?
Well, you're right. I mean, that is the danger, is that as you say, the next level down is going to suffer, but because in the future the top players have to come from somewhere. They've got to be some kind of qualifying system to the top level. But I to get back to the team thing, I love the team idea. I think team golf, I mean, the Ryder Cup, the President's Cup, the Solheim Cup, I mean, it's fantastic viewing. And I don't think, you say 8 weeks, there's got to be a way of coming up with a scenario whereby the players they're not going to be occupied for 8 weeks. If you make it knockout, you're only going to have maybe the two teams that get to the final of this thing going to be playing for 8 weeks. So chances are they'd be playing less than that. But I share your concern over the willingness of the top guys to play, you know, more than, say, 20, 22 weeks a year.
Speaking of team golf, nothing bigger than the Ryder Cup. You mentioned Luke Donald. He's going to be the captain again in 2025 at Bethpage Black. Are you of the sense that John Rahm will be on that European team, as Rory McIlroy said, whether he's wearing a LIV Golf jersey or not in 2025?
Well, things are going to have to change. If that's who knows what's going to happen in golf in the next few months, where none of us know exactly what's going to take place. But if it stays the way it is right now, and John Rahm starts to play in LIV events and doesn't pay the fines and serve the suspensions that would, as of the laws are right now, would come after that, he won't be playing in the Ryder Cup in 2025. But I suspect, as I'm sure you guys do, that things will change on that front. The European Tour, Europe, They don't have the depth, as we all know, of the American team or American squad. The Americans have a squad of players. They could probably come up with 2.5 teams, players good enough to play in the Ryder Cup. But if Europe doesn't have its absolute best team, it's not going to be nearly as much fun to watch because they wouldn't be nearly as competitive. So Ram is required, but whether he'll be there or not is going to depend on whether things change over the next few months.
There's something of a kerfuffle going on this week, 14 time zones away from you, John, out in Hawaii, where a lot of the graduates of the Korn Ferry Tour and Q School graduates have not been able to get a spot in the field this week at the Sony Open. And five of the DP World Tour's top 10 who qualified for tour cards are in the field. So there's the typical kind of parochial reactions that I'm sure won't surprise you on that. But does this lead to a broader question here of whether or not the tours, either DP World Tour or PGA Tour, just have too many players? Does it need to be more cutthroat that there are too many mediocre talents out there expecting to be accommodated at the most elite level of the game?
Yeah, there's always been that argument, hasn't there? Certainly, since the money rocketed in golf, it's the criticism I've heard from more than one top player, not just Rory, over the last few years, is that it's too easy to drift along, plod along, win your 750,000 or whatever it is, $1 million a year, and put no pressure on yourself. It's a purely a job. There's no ambition involved. There's no drive to be the best, that kind of thing. So I've not got too much sympathy for the rank and file in that respect, because the top players drive everything. It's always been that way. Certainly the European Tour back in the day, even when Seve, Faldo, Langer, Lyle, Woosnam were ruling the roost over there, that the tour was run basically for the benefit of the star players. And that's always going to be the case. But and there's also the argument that there are too many people turning pro, guys who are just not good enough. There's too many tours, I think, for even lower levels than the Korn Ferry. Guys turn pro with ambitions, and good luck to them. But the vast majority have absolutely no chance of making it. And maybe we need to streamline the whole professional golf system from top to bottom.
Just going back to one of the top stars we've been talking about a lot here, final question on Rory McIlroy. In his press conference or comments in Dubai today, the very last statement he made as he talked about this reorganizing of his life, clearing out the clutter, getting rid of all of the tour policy board politics and all of that, his last line was, "The final piece of the puzzle is knocking off one of those four," referring to the majors. That's whatever else we talk about with Rory as we move now into year 10. Since he last won a major, that's really what the conversation is going to be shadowing him all year long, isn't it?
Well, definitely, and one in particular, as you know. I mean, it was noticeable yesterday when I talked to him that I brought the subject of the Masters up, which is the one he needs to complete the Grand Slam. He already had a plan in place. He was very quick to say, "Oh, I'm going to play a bit more often in the run-up to the Masters. It's going to be his ninth, I think, or ninth or tenth event of 2024, rather than the sixth or the seventh." So, I mean, here we are in early January, and it's already on his mind, as you say. And when he says one of the four, I think he really means one of the four, the one in particular.
It's on his mind, and it's no doubt on our mind and many others as well. John, we appreciate your time today. Enjoy Dubai. We'll speak to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Anytime.
Stay with us. It's been an emotional comeback for Gary Woodland, who makes his first start since undergoing surgery to remove a brain lesion. Todd Lewis catches up with Woodland ahead of his powerful return.
We're only a week into the new year, but it's going to be tough to top this one as a feel-good story for the season. Gary Woodland back in action at the Sony Open after surgery to remove a lesion from his brain. We're going to hear from the former US Open champ about the dark days he's experienced and what lies ahead. And we're going to take the temperature over in the DP World Tour. The year kicks off in Dubai this week, and Tim Barter from Sky Sports will be here to tell us what we need to know as Golf Today continues now.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Wednesday, Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine, 1 hour down, 1 hour to go. In case you missed it, some big news On this Wednesday, the CEO of the R&A, Martin Slumbers, has announced that he will step down from his role at the end of 2024. He will oversee the running of this year's Open Championship at Royal Troon, the AIG Women's Open at St. Andrews, the Old Course, and then the Curtis Cup matches at Sunningdale before he steps down.
And Martin Slumbers released this statement earlier, Damon, saying, "It has been a privilege to serve golf at the highest level. It is a role that I've been proud to carry out on behalf of the R&A's employees, the members of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, and all our global partners. In any career, there is a time to allow the next generation to have its turn. I'm grateful to have had the honour for nearly a decade to have been the custodian of all that the R&A and the game of golf more broadly represents." So out in Hawaii, some of the players were asked on what the impact of Martin Slumbers will be.
I think obviously Martin's done a great job since he, took over from Peter. I think obviously the rollback is probably something that will be discussed about his time. But I think anyone who's in that position is obviously, trying to look out for the best interests of the game. And I think I'm sure he can be comfortable in saying that that's exactly what he's done. And I would say him doing what he's done is exactly that.
Well, the R&A has played a vital role, not only in the game of golf in Europe, but all around the world. But, the Open Championship, it is, I've said it before, you go over and play in the Open Championship and you get goosebumps. It's the home of golf. It's where it all began. So for him to lead that organization, I feel like he did a great job in 9 years there. So I think his legacy will be remembered really well in the game of golf. And 9 years to be, CEO of such a big organization in this game is something that I'm sure he's proud of, and he'll be missed, but hopefully he'll still be a part of it somehow.
I mean, obviously, his position with the R&A is one of the most sought after in golf. I mean, his office up there, above the 18th green in St. Andrews, probably is one of the most iconic offices in the world in any industry. So obviously to have had that role, he's obviously had opportunity to affect a lot of change. I mean, there's been a lot going on in the game of golf, and I think he's stayed very positive and neutral, as best he can in all of that. So he's also been a big supporter of all sorts of initiatives of which we've been sort of beneficiaries. The Rose Lady Series that we do in back home in the UK, R&A have always been very supportive of our cause, and we've always had a very open and direct line with Martin. So wish him well with whatever endeavour is next. And we'll miss him, but he's done a great job for us.
Justin Rose makes a great point. Who would want to give up that office overlooking the Old Course in St. Andrews? There is the top line of the career biography of Martin Slumbers. 9 years as a CEO of the R&A. Previously worked in investment banking and is a graduate of the University of Birmingham in England. Well, Damon, faces change. The game rolls on. PGA Tour is island hopping from Maui to Oahu this week for the Sony Open in Hawaii. And a reminder that you can catch live first round coverage tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Golf Channel. And here are some of the notables in the field. Ludvig Åberg got somewhat of a sober awakening last week when he struggled a little bit at Kapalua. Brian Harman, the Open champion, Siwoo Kim, who's the defending title holder. And there's one name there, Damon, that's getting a lot of attention this week.
You're not kidding. That, of course, Gary Woodland returning to professional golf at the Sony Open in Hawaii, where he made his first PGA Tour start, by the way, back in 2009. It'll be his first start on the PGA Tour since undergoing brain surgery back in September. Then an update was posted to his platforms on social media following that surgery in September, saying most of the tumor had been removed, grateful and thankful. And how remarkable was this? By November, Gary Woodland, a major champ, was back up hitting golf balls again and posting this to social media. "This journey has been very hard, but I'm extremely thankful to be progressing and for the unconditional love and support from everyone. You've all made this process a little easier for me and my family. Thank you to everyone. I look forward to seeing you all next year." And for more on this inspiring story, we say hello to Todd Lewis at the Sony. You had a chance to catch up with Gary Woodland.
Yes, I did, Damon, and it was quite inspirational. I want to take you back to last spring, just a couple of weeks after the Masters, and Gary felt the first symptoms, tremors. He called them jolts, and ultimately they were mild seizures. They were followed by dizziness, nauseousness, lack of focus, a lack of energy, and ultimately after consulting with doctors and having an MRI, it was discovered that he had a lesion on his brain. Now, they originally tried to treat that with medication, but ultimately his doctor said, we have to remove that lesion. So he went into surgery last September, and it was a very risky surgery. They cut a hole in his skull, basically the size of a baseball, and then removed the lesion and then put a titanium plate back to cover up that hole. As I mentioned, it was a risky surgery. He could have lost his sight. He could have had partial paralysis or even worse. But he recovered beautifully. And remarkably, 4 months later, he is back out on the PGA Tour competing this week in the Sony Open. I had a chance to talk to Gary yesterday, and he talked about the road back to doing what he loves to do and being surrounded by those who love him. Gary, first, it is great to see you back.
Thank you.
I do want to go back to last year. You said you were having symptoms of partial seizures, jolting, you were fatigued, memory loss. I've known you for a long time. You've been a very positive, optimistic person. What was your attitude when all that was happening and you were talking to doctors?
It was awful, because it was just new for me. It wasn't myself. And to, like I said, to be 39 years old and all of a sudden you don't feel like yourself when you've, it was horrible. And luckily, Gabby was there with me. My team knew what I was going through, so they were very supportive, but it was something we couldn't stop either. Yeah. I mean, this was an everyday occurrence. The fear and anxiety I was dealing with just wouldn't go away. And so, fortunately, with the meds, the seizures started to go away, but that didn't help the symptoms I was dealing with. And it was, golf was a little break when I could fight through it, when I could play, but it was something I hopefully I never experience again.
It's a powerful emotion, fear. How would you describe that fear?
Awful. I mean,
what were you fearful of?
Death. Everything was death. It was doomsday, end of the world. And it was everything from whether I was driving a car or getting on an airplane. My kids are playing candles lit in the kitchen. I'm like, babe, the house is going to burn down. And it was it was awful. And the golf fear came, if I jolted in the middle of the night before a round, wake up with a seizure, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to play golf today. I can't play golf today. And getting nauseous, getting so worked up, my brain's going so fast, start getting sick, show up at a golf tournament, not have the focus to play, forget what club I'm hitting. Fortunately, I was practicing and playing good golf. I just wasn't able to sustain it, but surgery helped. That's gone away.
Right, let me stop you there. Yeah. I'm sure you had fear going into the surgery, but when you woke up from that surgery, how would you describe those emotions?
I was overwhelmed with thankfulness, love. My wife was standing in front of me when I woke up. I was 2 days in the hospital before I got to see my kids. When I got home, obviously winning the U.S. Open, I wanted to see my dad. I wanted to get there. I was on Father's Day. I wanted to hug my dad. When I was able to hug my kids after surgery, I don't think there's anything better.
How would you describe the love and support you had since recovery and even before the surgery?
It's been overwhelming. The golf world has really rallied. It's been absolutely amazing. We're obviously in an individual sport. We're out here battling with each other every week. It's felt like everyone's a team. Everyone's a family. Being out here, seeing the guys again, I haven't seen a lot of guys. I've seen, Ricky and some guys back home who have been amazing. But it's been overwhelming. The love and support, not only for me, but for my family. My family's, this has been a hard process on me, but it's been harder on my family and my team who have been there with me and had to experience this firsthand. The love and support we've had from everyone has helped us get through this.
I know you got a positive person in your camp in Butch Harmon. What's he saying about your golf swing?
Butch is saying it's getting better. He's just checking in on me today as well. It's been great. I've been out to see him once, which was nice. He came down to Florida, so I saw him there as well. Butch, he's more than a coach to me, so it's been it's been nice to have him in my corner through this process. But he says I'm right where I need to be, so hopefully I can go out and do that this week.
Beautiful. Final thing, it's a two-part question. What do you hope to prove to yourself and to others this week and the rest of your career?
The big deal is you can overcome. That a big obstacle, a big deal like this isn't an end of your career and it's not a roadblock. This is going to be a jump start for me. I want to prove to my kids that you can overcome. You can deal with stuff that's thrown at you that you're not expecting. You stay positive, you surround yourself with the right people, and you work hard. And that's what I've been doing. I've been working extremely hard. I've had the right people around me, the right support staff, and I believe this is the start of something great.
Biggest test this week for you will be what?
The focus. Physically, I can hit every shot. I know that. The game's been good. I've been working and training hard. But being able to stay in it for 7 days will be a challenge, but it's one I'm looking forward to.
Well, as you can tell in that video, Gary is very healthy. Physically, he feels like he's ready to go. But, yes, he wants to see if he can remain focused through four rounds of golf here at the Sony Open in this obviously highly competitive arena. Now, he made the determination just last week to play here at the Sony Open. He spent 10 days on the Big Island working out, playing a lot of golf, and he ultimately decided after talking with his team and his wife, Gabby, that, yeah, I feel like I'm ready to give it a go, to test out what I got here at the Sony Open this week. And regardless of what he shoots, I can tell you, he's going to lead the field this week in strokes gained hugs. I mean, everyone is embracing him, players, caddies, rules officials, media members. It is such a blessing to have Gary Woodland back out here on the PGA Tour.
Todd, on that note, you've had some heavy, heavy stories at the beginning of 2024. Chris Kirk talking about the sobriety he has and the importance of his family and also the people on the PGA Tour who have supported him, and Gary Woodland as well, talking about the doctors, yes, and his family, but also the embrace that he feels by the PGA Tour peers that he will play against tomorrow. How would you describe the closeness of the fraternity out there week to week? You're out there as much as anyone.
Well, first off, yes, they're out here competing. They're out here as entertainers. They want to win each and every week. They tee it up. But this is a traveling circus. We all travel together out here on the PGA Tour, and we get to know each other. We respect everyone out here, regardless of what your job is. And when someone is in crisis, you mentioned Chris Kirk, Gary Woodland, obviously, we rally around him. And this is a family out here. So they have been supporting both Chris and Gary, Gary most recently, with all kinds of love and just notes and texts of inspiration to him, giving him hope and optimism. As you could tell there in that piece, he was very, very fearful. That lesion was on the part of the brain that controls the emotion of fear. So he needed to be lifted up, and the PGA Tour surely did that.
A wonderful interview, Todd. We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Just struck by that and reading the Golf Digest piece on Gary Woodland as well, and then hearing Todd with that interview with Gary. He's such a big, strong guy, a national champion, a former basketball player, and to read the description of the fear that he had and clutching the mattress and scared that he was going to lose his life and lose his kids, and him describing to Todd about a flame in the kitchen and worried that the house is going to burn down. It's hard to imagine Gary Woodland in that vulnerable place.
It's a horrific way to get perspective on life and what really matters, I suppose. And it's great to see Gary Woodland looking so healthy now, because as Todd said, you really won't find an enemy in Gary Woodland's world out there. He just is one of the more amiable guys on this tour and treats everyone with respect, which I think is what is now coming back to him over the last year when he's gone through this. But he is a competitor at heart.
Yeah.
And you can tell Gary Woodland by the work that he's been putting in and the reference to Butch Harmon, he wants to play well. He's not coming out here just to get hugs and say, hey guys, I'm back. He's out here to try to reestablish a career that has given him four wins on the PGA Tour, and most recently was at the US Open at Pebble Beach 4 years ago almost. So there's definitely that fire in him. But, you know, it's definitely been tempered. It has to have been tempered by an experience like this, because his comments, during his press conference yesterday, would really have brought a tear from a stone just on how low he was actually brought by this illness and the fear of what it could turn into.
That's the thing. You know, we get these sheets and these printouts, and you read that, you know, Gary Woodland is about to undergo surgery, as we found out in the fall. But I didn't know the depth of his despair. You know, we're reading the stories and learning about, you know, a very popular player on the PGA Tour. I had no idea that he was going through what he had gone through until today. And when I think about Gary Woodland, I smile, because I've been able to interview him a few times. One year he was at Nota Begay's charity event, and he was on the driving range with Nicholas Kolsarts. At that time, those were two of the longest hitters in the game of golf, and they decided to have some fun, do a little bit of a drive contest to see who could out-hit the other. And Gary absolutely was Walmarting it past Nicholas, and Nicholas was swinging out of his shoes trying to keep up with Gary. You could just see the kind of jock-tough mentality that Gary had, and you're right, and I know that this being behind him now, and hopefully that it is, and he said hopefully it never comes back, you know that he just wants to be out there, you know, bumping elbows with the best players in the world, because that's what he's always loved to do, you know, going toe-to-toe, going head-to-head with the best in the game.
And we've seen some tremendously emotional wins in this game in the last few months. It's probably too much to hope for that this weekend. Let's just hope that he gets some positive signs on his game. But just being back, well, that's a victory in and of itself right now.
Absolutely looking forward to watching Gary Wilmot compete